This edition of Meet the Writers was recorded in front of a live audience at Daunt Bookshop in Marylebone, London, on the 15th of September 2021.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to Daunt Books. Welcome back after an age. It is a real pleasure to have you all back here as an audience. We've done all sorts of things on live events, streamed events. It is not the same. So thank you all for being here this evening. And what a way to start this evening. We're delighted to welcome Sebastian Faulks here to talk about Snow Country. I won't say much more about it because they're better than I here to talk about it. But if I just say that for the author of Birdsong, Paris Echo, Human Traces, when the Telegraph says Faulks on his best form, you know just how good this wonderful sweeping novel of early 20th century Europe is. And I'm delighted to have a real professional here this evening to put the questions. Georgina Godwin, who is books editor at Monocle 24, our near neighbours around the corner. She's also the presenter of one of the finest literary podcasts you will find out there, the Meet the Writers podcast, every Sunday. Georgina, is that right? I really recommend, if you haven't already caught it, please do catch up with it. Please welcome Sebastian Faulks and Georgina Godwin. Thank you both.
Thank you. Plus, that's nice. I hardly ever get introduced like that. Sebastian, it's such a joy to be here with you, particularly as it's the first time that we've done this post-pandemic. How does it feel for you being out in the world?
It feels quite strange. Thank you all for coming and braving the pandemic, and it's great to... It's pretty good fun, is the simple answer. I think I've gone from, like everybody else, sort of 18 months of isolation into a sort of tour of the country, and we've been to so many different places and crowds and festivals and so on. So it's quite a shock. It's quite a change. But so far, so good.
I wonder if there's a sense as a writer that you're never really out of lockdown around you. It doesn't really matter.
I think it's dangerous to feel that or to think that, really. I think you have to be part of the world as a writer. You have to meet people, talk to them, even when you don't really want to sometimes, overhear them, be bored by them, irritated by them, to warm to them, like them, love them, whatever. But I think you need to keep in touch with people. I do a lot of it in books, actually. I mean, I find the best way to meet people is through what they write. However, of course, you know, lockdown for me didn't really change my work a great deal. I mean, I work from home, so everyone else joined me in working from home. Also, writing during I finished the book last summer. At that time, April, May, if you remember, the weather was very remarkable. It was very clear and bright, but also quite cold. And it made me think a lot about the period of Spanish flu, which I had touched on before. In fact, the main character in Birdsong, Isabel, dies from it. And without wanting to spoil the plot too much, a character in Snow Country dies from it as well. This all the time while hearing, reading newspaper columnists aged about 25 saying, this unprecedented pandemic. Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I see we have a drink, so
cheers.
Cheers. Last time Sebastian and I were drinking together, it was not allowed. We were in Sri Lanka in a dry restaurant, and it was a priest.
Yes. Luckily we had a Catholic priest. I think he was Irish, wasn't he?
Almost definitely.
The restaurant was Muslim, but he was Catholic, and there was a sort of religious battle, and it was conducted under the table. There was a lot of whiskey was slushed around, and I felt slightly bad that I felt I had disrespected the beliefs of the owners of the restaurant. But on the other hand, the priest was very persuasive.
He was extremely persuasive.
I was very thirsty.
So, Sebastian, really in your head, well, at least until the summer, you spent most of that time in 19th century Austria, which is where Snow Country is set. Can you tell us a little bit about Vienna at that time?
Yeah.
It was the last gasp of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And so every day the emperor is driven in his open horse-drawn carriage from one palace to another. It is a place of great intellectual ferment, psychoanalytic. I mean, Freud's case studies have started being published in the 1890s, but in terms of psychology and the discussion of how men and women think and behave, there's a lot going on. In art and literature, you have Klimt and Schiller and the secession, and so there's a heck of a lot going on. It's also a very corrupt place. My main character, Anton, arrives in 1910 as a student, and he comes from a very middle-class bourgeois family of sausage makers in a great friend of mine who's Austrian, his family of sausage makers. But anyway, it just seemed to me to sum up a certain sort of Austrian bourgeois thing to do. And he comes there and he's very struck by the number of available women on the street. I mean, they literally line up along the street and they have an arrangement with the police whereby they have to stand behind a certain line which is painted down the middle of the pavement so that the respectable passers-by can walk along unmolested by these women. And this is quite shocking. And, you know, there are books being written all this time by mostly by men, I have to say, talking about how all women are naturally polyamorous and should have as many lovers as possible, and equally Freud and other people saying that, no, it's men who need to have as many lovers as possible and so on. So my character, Anton, finds himself in the middle of this sort of ferment. And he's quite a romantic soul, really, and he thinks, we really ought to have figured out by now how men and women need to relate to one another and what's right and what's wrong and what will make them happy and what is proper and so on. Anyway, his problems with this are solved when he falls in love with a French woman who is a governess to a rich family in a posh suburb of Vienna. This solves his problems for the time being, but then they get worse when he works as a journalist. He has to work all the time because his parents won't pay for him to be at the university because they want him to read law or medicine, like good sausage makers do. And he wants to read philosophy because he realizes that's the soft option. Anyway, he becomes reasonably employable. I wouldn't say successful, but employable as a journalist. And he finds himself in Paris in 1914, where he's reporting on a very sensational murder trial of a woman called Henriette Caillaux, who was the wife of the finance minister, who had walked into the office of the editor of the Figaro and shot him dead with a pistol.
So this is all true?
This is all true. So it's like Rishi Sunak's wife had gone in and shot John Witherow through the heart. You know, many of us have wanted to do John. No, that's a joke, John, yes, please. And this is taking place in the 2 or 3 days before the First World War breaks out. And Paris is completely deflected from the fact that the whole world is drifting into this cataclysm by speculation about the sex life of Henriette Caillaux and her husband and so on. War breaks out, Anton is stranded in Paris, can't get home to Austria. His French lover, Delphine, is stranded in Vienna. So that's how the story sort of kicks off, as it were.
And Delphine is a pianist. And, of course, at that time in Austria, there was a wonderful explosion of music. And I wondered if you immersed yourself in it at all while you were writing and what role music has in your process.
Not a great deal, to be honest. I've got a bit of a tin ear. But I felt I should talk about it a bit. And so there's a scene where they go to a concert and they first of all sit through a Schoenberg. It's a string quartet. So I listened to this, obviously, myself, and I was rather amazed when a soprano comes in. I thought it was a string quartet, anyway. And Anton really hates it, but Delphine quite likes it. And then luckily we have a nice bit of Mahler to follow. So I want to give you a sense of it, but I cannot pretend to have a sort of deep musical feeling or education. So it is quite in the background. When I was first started writing, I used to listen to music all the time, turned on quite low under headphones. I found it helped me to concentrate, but I don't find that at all anymore. I find it incredibly distracting.
You've spoken before, though, about writing being possibly similar to a symphony where you're bringing in different bits of the orchestra.
In terms of structuring a book, I like to think that my books are structured rather in a symphonic way. They have, you know, four movements and something is set out, the main themes, and then a secondary theme. And then in this book, you meet the secondary theme, as it were, who is a character called Lena. I mean, I learned a great deal when I was a student, actually, and a student reading English. You haven't got a great deal to do other than read books and listen to music and go to films. So that's what I did, and I was keen to educate myself. So I bought, you know, Beethoven and Mahler and Sibelius and Bruckner, and I listened to them a lot in a rather unmusical, ignorant way. But one thing I did understand was how they were put together, and I loved the way that the main themes were recapitulated and then brought to a sort of triumphant conclusion. And I learned a great deal about how to construct a novel, or at least how to construct the kind of novel that I was interested in writing anyway, from listening to these quite classical composers. And as for storytelling, I think I learned more from films, really. But that's another topic.
This is also, Vienna at this time is obviously, as you've mentioned, when we're seeing the huge rise of psychoanalysis. And the book, which is the first in the trilogy, I think we mentioned Human Traces is the first. This is the second in the trilogy. It's, I guess you would say, it's about consciousness, individuality, and what it means to be human, but all set around this sanatorium. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit, because it links it, doesn't it? Both books have the Schloss Sieblick in it.
Yeah.
If you could just tell us a bit about that place.
Yes, I'm hoping to complete three books, which are a very loosely linked trilogy, but they're not sequels to one another. They're in the same way that Birdsong and Charlotte Gray and The Girl at the Lion d'Or are marketed, really, is the only word to put it, as a French trilogy, basically because they're all set in France, but they're not sequels. They're very minute crossovers between the characters, but you don't need to understand them or know about them. In fact, there are one or two cross-references from Snow Country to Birdsong, in fact, but it doesn't spoil it for you if you don't pick them up at all. But Human Traces, which came out in 2005, was a very long book and a very serious book, and it was about the beginnings of psychoanalysis. It was about the beginnings of psychiatry and people with great good faith and goodwill and energy trying to work out why human beings seemed so flawed and so broken and why so many of us seemed to suffer from mental illness. And of course, the big Victorian asylums, which were built in this country in the 1850s and 1860s, were a sort of starting place. But unfortunately, they just gathered together people who were suffering from a huge range of disorders, many of them which wouldn't now be classified as mental disorders anyway, things like epilepsy, or in some cases they just became a dumping ground for people that local towns and villages didn't want to look after. I remember going to research that and going to a very famous hospital in North London called Free and Barnet, which had actually closed by then, by the late 90s. But I did speak to a doctor who had worked there, and he said that when he joined in about the very last gasp of it, admittedly, I think the late 80s, that something like 70% of his patients had been born there. So you could tell how that system had sort of failed. What interested me was the sort of difference between the way that doctors try to go about helping people. And there was a very strong biological school which says that a great deal of mental distress or mental illness, whatever you want to call it, is caused by inherited factors, it has a sort of biological basis. And there are other people who said that if you could find out what was troubling someone by talking to them, then Freud in particular would say, you know, he offered almost formulae, or almost like Newton's laws of motion. You know, your feeling of this is in inverse proportion to your feeling or suppression of that. Both things had something to be said for them. And this book, Snow Country, does look, it returns to the sanatorium, which is founded in Human Traces by the two main characters, one of whom represents one point of view and the other point of view. But it doesn't go into anything like the same medical or neurological detail. It is basically a love story. And although it's very concerned with the idea of human consciousness and the good things and the bad things about this one faculty, which seems to separate us from all other creatures on the planet, and it touches on the questions that modern neuroscientists have asked of whether there is such a thing as the individual self at all. I mean, the consensus in modern science, I think, would say that there isn't. It's what they call a convenient fiction. It helps us to believe that we have a self different from everyone else, but basically we're just a sort of flux of electrochemical activity. This is getting rather technical, isn't it? Let me remind myself that I failed chemistry O-level at this point. And let me remind you that it remains a love story, and it's a very much more approachable book than Human Traces. But I hope if people like this, they will then go back to Human Traces and read it afterwards.
Because it doesn't really matter which way around you read them.
No, I think there's something to be said for reading books out of order, actually. There isn't a great deal of crossover, but one of the main characters in this, the woman who now runs the sanatorium, is the daughter of one of the guys who set it up. And we last saw her as a little girl trotting off to school with her twin sister. And now we see her as a rather efficient, formidable manager of the place and also a therapist herself. And I think it's fun to do in books what you can't do in life, which is to dial back, go back in time and see people when they were children. Mm. It's effective, I think, and it can be touching.
I mean, as you say, there is a line through, even from Birdsong, from your French trilogy, to this. And of course, there's a dialogue between these two books. And I wondered if you saw your your entire oeuvre, really, as one story?
I mean, there are writers that, you know, I've seen this happen. I mean, Forster, E.M. Forster, you get a tiny walk-on. I forget how it goes now. I think it's Mrs. Moore, who's a character in Passage from India, has a walk-on in Howard's End, or I may have got that wrong. I like that, but I think the important thing is that it's not essential. I think the important thing is that the reader can pick up any single book and really enjoy it on its own. But, you know, as one or two reviews and one or two interviews have sort of pointed out, I am now rather a sort of old geezer, really. And they've put it more politely than that, but I just couldn't think of the words they used. And it's only in retrospect that you see what you were trying to do, really. When I started out, I was just trying to get a book into print. I was trying to stun the world and say, here I am, and so on. And the world was very uninterested. And it took me about 4 shots to get into print, and eventually I did. I was nearly 30 by the time I did. And then it's only in retrospect you begin to see patterns and shapes among the things you've written. And, you know, maybe they are all connected. Well, they're likely to be, really, aren't they? Although I make a big show of saying that nothing of my life is in my books. It's all invented. They're all fictional characters. They're all removed from me, living at different times in different countries. I write a lot about women, etc. At the same time, they've come out of here and they've come through here. So, you know, they have a family feeling.
And of course, the book talks about inherited trauma, or what we might describe today as epigenetics. Mm. Obviously, war is something that is in the background of many of your books. And I wonder then if that harks back to your father's experience in the war, and indeed you growing up immediately post-war and with the shadow of the Cold War.
Yes, I suppose so. I was born in the 50s and brought up in the 60s, but so were some people in this room, I imagine. And I don't think that my family's experience of it was any particularly different from anyone else's. To me, the interesting thing was why no one else had really written about this. I mean, when I was trying to learn how to write, I suppose, in the 70s, reading a lot of contemporary fiction by people of the generation older than mine, writers like Iris Murdoch or Anthony Burgess or Kingsley Amis, John Fowles. Fowles wrote about the war, actually, in The Magus, or The Magus, as he called it. I'm sure he knew what his own book was called. But
That's changed my worldview, actually.
But mostly, you know, these were all people who were of an age, and it was never mentioned. I mean, Iris Murdoch's characters were, they must have been 30 in 1940. It just passed them by. But to me, it was something there, and I think growing up, you know, Dad had fought and been wounded, and I just remember this being a fact. He never banged on about it. He was delighted it was over and was very set on having a happy life in, you know, a nice house and a nice wife and 2 little boys. And then I think when I reached the age of about 16, whatever it is, you first become rather, you know, stroppy and questioning, thinking, well, I've been brought up in this lovely family and they keep telling me everything's all right, but we've had the Cuban Missile Crisis when the world nearly was blown to pieces, and now we have, you know, 2 hands of 2 rather unstable men hovering over the nuclear trigger. It isn't that great, is it? So I think I wanted to know how we'd got there and then what kind, you know, who we were. And then having written a few books about that, I decided that human beings were very odd indeed. And so that's what my latter books have been about. Why are humans so odd? Mm.
Well, Lena certainly comes from a very odd background. If anybody has inherited trauma, she has reason to. You describe her life as a war with need. Mm. And I wonder if you could tell us more about her, and particularly her mother.
Yes, Lena is the main female character in the book. And she comes from yet another imagined town in Austria. And I quite simply got the idea from her from a book I read by a nurse called Christy Watson, which is called The Language of Kindness, which I warmly recommend if you haven't read it. It's a casebook of people she's looked after as a nurse, but she's also a very, very good writer. And she talked about one person she looked after who was an alcoholic and who was only happy when she was pregnant. And she was in hospital acutely unwell and she was looked after. And to me, the interesting thing was, you know, what would it be like to be the child of such a person? Because presumably quite a few of these babies are actually born. And so that's where the idea came from. And so Lena grows up with nothing, but the church and the hospital looks after her to some extent. And she goes to school, but she doesn't really get on at school. This is a bit like me, actually, I think. Having said I don't put anything of myself into it. She just can't really understand what it's all about, the blackboard. What does it matter if 2 + 2 = 4? What are these letters, the one that was Z that looks like this? Who cares, you know? I think this is true with a lot of children. You know, you're very frustrated by school. And luckily for me, at some point, I just had a teacher and the penny dropped and suddenly I cared a lot about long division. I cannot imagine why, but a lot of kids never do, and she doesn't. So she leaves home early, leaves school early, and then goes off as soon as she can to make her way in the world. And so, yeah, her Anton's project, if you like, to use a rather sort of psychotherapeutic term, is to find a sense of purpose, because he feels superfluous, really. And Lena's project is to find a way of surviving. And she survives because she feels entitled to survive. And despite her disadvantages, she has a strong sense of, I am alive and I have a right to live. And how she goes about expressing this and finding a place in the world is a very bumpy ride. Mm. But we better not say too much. Plot alert. Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Spoiler alert. So, but a little bit perhaps about sex, because everybody likes to talk about sex. I mean, she finds some comfort in it, but Anton, as you said at the beginning, he finds the whole of Vienna very dissolute, although later, of course, changes his opinion on that. Martha, the little girl who now runs the sanatorium, she had a wonderful quote from her. She talks about how the emotional and the spiritual are not elevated above the physical, and that there is a place in the human animal where shame and joy are very close together. I thought that that was fascinating, and I wondered if you'd just unpack that.
Yeah, I think that Martha, whose own romantic and sexual life has been fine, she's had a couple of lovers, and she has no sort of problems in that area. But her interest is in dealing with the problems that her patients bring to her. So she's read a lot, and she's open-minded, as you must be as a therapist. But she realizes, well, I actually pinched this phrase from Thomas Mann, The Magic Mountain, which I read. I'd read it before, but I read it again while writing this book. And early on, he has this great phrase when he's talking about sex. He has this phrase which says, the boundless joys of shame. And I just thought that was so good. In fact, I think Martha quotes it at some point. And, you know, it is a very powerful thing. But the difficulty that everyone has is how to regulate it, too much, too little, this person, that person, not at all. It's a hard thing to master. And I don't think some human beings find a very satisfactory solution to it, and some don't, and most muddle along somewhere in the middle. But it is an interesting subject, and you know, we all tend to laugh about it a bit because so often it is funny, because so often it is undignified and silly and regrettable, but so often it isn't. And when it isn't, and when it's connected to other things, you know, I'm not really talking about sex here, I'm talking about, you know, romantic love, the sense of finding one other person, which has persisted in our lives. I mean, it's probably a literary idea, it's probably an artistic idea, but it has massive appeal. And many people do believe, including me, that loving one person can be a transcendent experience and can lift you out above and beyond the normal way of feeling alive. And of course it is literature and art and music which has inflamed this belief, but they couldn't have done it unless there was something deep in us that believed it.
I wondered if you'd tell us a little bit about the Japanese book that shares its name.
Snow Country is, I liked the title. There was a Japanese novelist called Kawabata who wrote a book called Snow Country. It took him about 30 years to write it, but it's only about 120 pages. Rather the opposite of me. He published it in several sections over a very long time. And it's a very beautiful book, very Japanese, very culturally fascinating. It has the most beautiful opening when a train pulls into a remote hill station under heavy snow. And I've always remembered it. And then I thought, I was in New York actually, and at a dinner party and discussing what I was going to call my next book. And I said, I think it's going to be called The House on Snow Lake. And people looked a bit about that. And I said, what I really want to call it is Snow Country. And this guy called Jonathan Galassi, who was the head of Farrar Straus Publishers, said, yeah, but Kawabata's taken that title. I said, yes, Jonathan, but only you and I know that. And so I've thanked him he died many, many decades ago for the loan of his title.
Anything else from the audience? My glass is on, so I can see if you're waving at me. I'll give you a minute to think about it while we talk about Panama, because, of course, he goes off to the building of the Panama Canal and has really a very seminal experience. He talks about his awe at human insignificance in the face of nature and being connected somehow. And he talks also about reincarnation and how it may not be being reincarnated as another person, but yourselves coming together.
Yes. Anton is sent one of his first assignments to the Panama Canal, which is an incredible story how it was built. De Lesseps, the Frenchman who'd built the Suez Canal, cut a line through the sand, but Panama proposed very, very, very different problems. And I'm not going to bore you with how they were solved. It's not a very long passage in the book, but it's really about Europeans traveling to other sides of the world and feeling themselves very, very insignificant in the face of nature. And Anton at this point is separated from his great love, Delphine, who's still in Vienna. And he feels himself beginning to sort of come apart because he's not connected to her anymore. But it's also there because he is going to go to the Schloss Seyblick to write an article about it, where he will discover a long diary written by one of the guys from Human Traces, Jacques, who goes off across America in a train in the 1890s. And again, feels himself rather coming apart away from his wife. And he feels this thing of human insignificance, and he wonders whether human beings really have a self which is different from that of other people. And this thought really panics him, because if I am not really distinct from other people, then when I die, my consciousness or something so like it as to be indistinguishable will carry on existing in someone else. And to him, this is an intolerable thought, because after all, life is quite difficult. And although I've been incredibly lucky in my life, quite want an ending. You see a child in a supermarket and its mother is, or father is, being unkind to it. And you think, oh God, here we go again. You know, I don't want another go round.
I mean, you ask, or he asks himself, what does it mean to be whole? Do we know the answer?
I don't. Who asks that? Anton? I don't know. I think I'm too young. When I've written the third volume of the trilogy, which will be in about 5 years' time, and I've answered all these difficult questions to at least my satisfaction, maybe I'll give you a better answer.
This is, as you say, the second part of the trilogy, third one coming. When Anton's asked if he's going to write another book, he says, there are too many books already, don't you think? What do we have left to tell each other? Presumably you disagree.
Oh, I think if you ever, if you're writing and you ever have a sort of writerly question like that, you become slightly self-conscious and you know that people think, oh, this is what he thinks. Yeah, I mean, obviously far too many trees are killed and, you know, most books are not very good, and you have to really think that you're not just doing it to make a living or to amuse yourself or because you can't do anything else. You have to think that you have something vital or valuable to contribute. And I do hope and believe that. I think he also says something about the physical endeavour involved in writing a book. People say, where'd you get the idea from? You know, where'd you get your ideas from? If only it were an idea. It's 1,000 ideas which go together and breed another million. And you have to control all of them. And then you have to pick every word in every sentence. And then you have to revise it 10,000 times. So, you know, when you're 30, that's feasible. But it becomes increasingly, it's almost physically demanding. But luckily, touch wood, this is wood, isn't it? I'm feeling pretty sprightly and I'm still up for the battle.
Fantastic. Well, we look forward to the next one. Sebastian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
My thanks to Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, Peter Barrett, all at Daunt's Bookshop, and you, the listeners.